Smadarat Marsha.
Okay. Top, we'll have one shirt in English, and just to give you girls a break, and then we'll go back to Hebrew next week. Okay. You're too excited. Okay. Rav Amital was willing to explore stereotyped approaches to Avodas Hashem that had become a little bit worn and outdated, especially because he was trying to shift the Torah world from the world of Europe to the modern world. And let's say in the Haredi world, and just exciting to see all the celebrations of the Daf Yomi last night, I was in much more of a Haredi-type celebration. The approach is more or less to preserve the old world and superimpose it on a modern world and then always invite that superimposition and overlay. And Rav Amital was looking to keep the traditional spirit intact while still finding modern energy for a modern formulation. So I think one area that was always stunning to me was his wrestling with Yerushalayim. How do we make sense of Yerushalayim in the modern world? Remember I told you earlier this year that Rabbi Ibn Pakuda, the Talmud of the Ramban, claimed that Hakaras HaTov lies at the core of religious identity. Be thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for your life, for your health, for your family. And Rav Amital felt that after the Holocaust, even though theoretically we still are grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, viscerally it's hard to pivot Avodas Hashem and religious identity on great gratitude because it's hard to feel such gratitude after we suffered so miserably and were persecuted so brutally. So how do you define a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a post-gratitude world? And Rav Amital always forced us to be very honest and authentic in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu because Hashem doesn't want forgery. And there's always that balance between traditionalism and adaptation. And you want to become more authentic and expressive and reflective of your reality, then you sometimes have to walk away from old models because the old models become outdated. And if you preserve old models, you may not be as authentic as you're still living in Poland, but then it's safe. And so it's a very delicate balance in life, in every area of life, to be traditionalist as well as fresh and authentic. So I want to broaden out this year, not just to talk about Yerushalayim, but for example, I always quote this issue, and not that I'm really telling you what to do, but I want you to have this conversation. When you get married, and you and your husband decide, as some of you will be discussing Emir Tashem, Bezos Hashem, you'll be discussing, well, can I make Yiddish? Can I cut the challah? So on the one hand, that's a halachic-free question. There's really no halachas about whether a woman, there's no din of tzibor, there's no kol isha, there's no yechayev and kiddush the same way I'm chayev and kiddush, yechayev and challah the same way I'm chayev and challah. So on that note, it's really neutral. It's a halachically neutral activity in that respect. Man or woman can perform it. But our tradition has already established that the man makes kiddush and the wife lights candles, and you can decide you want to create a new tradition, but you're severing yourself and your family from what we've established for 2,000 years. And then your children will have a harder time feeling part of the Masara and feeling part of the tradition. Because when they see pictures and books about the Shabbos table and about the women laying the candles and the making motzi, it won't resonate as much. So you can make whatever decision you want. And I'm not clocking it with my opinion. In our house, we don't do it for that reason. And you could choose if I'd be happy to eat at your house if you invite me. It's not a lucky question, depending on how good your cake is, or your husband's cake. I don't know if you got there, right? But, right, depending on who bakes it. Right. If you bring some popcorn, I'm a sucker for skinny popcorn. But I know. Save me, Andy. You already finished, right? So, you know, as she's squeezing the air out of the empty bag. What are you rubbing it in? Like, can you give me any? Okay. Yeah, the kernel that gets stuck in your teeth. Right? Not a good idea. Okay. Anyway, I'm funnier in English, right? Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about Yerushalayim today, okay? Yerushalayim is at the core of religious identity. This is how we refer to someone. Is he or she a Yerei Shamayim? That's the equivalent to saying, are they serious about religion? Some people perform religion, check the boxes of religion. Some people invest in religion. They feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. One of the phrases we apply is Yerei Shamayim. It's a Yerei Shamayim. He's a Yerei Shamayim. She's a Yerei Shamayim. How do you build Yerei Shamayim? What's it built upon? So Rav Amital first established that this is not something you should take for granted. Just lock in. Yerei Shamayim will occur automatically in a religious mind, religious consciousness. So for example, Shlomo Melech says in Mishlei, source number one, Im tevakshena kakesef v'chemat monim techapsena. So there are four different aspects of this pasuk which reminds us that Yerushalayim is not a given. Two are the verbs that describe the pursuit of Yerushalayim. Tivakshena, tichapsena. you have to pursue and investigate. It's not something that's obvious. You think it's obvious, you have to be a mevakesh Yirat Shamayim. You have to be a mechapes or a mechapes Yirat Shamayim. Second of all, you have to be a tavin. It's not just an emotional experience where you think it's spiritual and emotional. There's thought, there's contemplation, az tavin. And the third ingredient is the parallel between az tavin yiras Hashem v'das Elokim timtzas. So evidently, the gateway to Yirat Shamayim is parallel to Das Elokim. Somehow knowing, thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu will yield Yirat Shamayim. So the Maseilas Yesharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an Italian rabbi in the early 18th century, a Mekubal, and he had some very, very provocative Kabbalistic thoughts which led to the banning of many of his... You studied this? You heard? Right, so... And the only reason we read the Maseilas Yesharim today, who validated his sefer, you know? The Vilna Gaon, about 70 years later, so people said 50 years later should start reading Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, an Italian rabbi, say from Maseilas Yesharim. He is about 100 years or 80 years before the Muslim movement, but he writes what becomes the Bible of the Muslim movement. We'll talk a little bit today about the Muslim movement. He writes the Bible 80 years before the Muslim movement becomes a movement. So he's not conscious of a movement, but he writes a sefer trying to stress that these areas of Yirat Shamayim, Avodas Hashem, they have to be studied and thought about the same way you tackle or investigate a sugya. It's not going to happen automatically. For hundreds of years, it did happen automatically. The sense of Devar Hashem, the sense that when you're studying Torah, you're talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he's in the room, was so morally formative that people didn't need to focus on moral experience directly. It was just so obvious. You're learning Torah. Of course you're humble. Of course you're sensitive. Of course you're kind. Of course you keep mitzvahs. Of course you're passionate about davening. But at some level, in the 16th century, 17th, there's going to be a disconnect between study, the head, and the heart, the spirit. And to try to recreate that spiritual awareness, Musar, the Musar movement in the early 19th century responded. But anyway, in the Maseilas Yesharim, in his introduction, he actually quotes this pasuk. This becomes his anthem. This becomes his, I don't want to say slogan, in a worn and out-used fashion, this becomes the baseline of a sefer. Amar Shlomo, im techapsena kakesef, source 3, v'chematmonim techapsena az tevin yiras Hashem. Taking some drabs. Again, he wasn't against secular knowledge. He's not denying the importance of secular knowledge. He says, eino omer az tevin philosophia. Doesn't mean, oh, then you'll understand philosophy. Az tevin chuna, you'll understand math. Az tevin refua, az tevin dinim, az tevin halachos. He's not denying the validity of these studies. He's just saying that Shlomo Melech, who's the Chacham Mikol Adam, is not encouraging thought and meditation or contemplation to understand philosophy better or math, which is obvious, but even Yirat Shamayim, which is less obvious because the landscape is more spiritual and more vague. Okay? Oh, he says, Hanim Sazman, three lines from the bottom, L'chol Shar Chel Ke Ha'iyun. We spend time investigating all areas of Torah study. Ulian hazed lo yisman, and for investigating ourselves, lama lo yikba adam liatzmo itim lefachos lehistaklus hazed. Why shouldn't you designate time for this introspection? Im muchachu b'sheres manu lefanos eliyunim ol asakim machrim. You spend so much time in business, so much time studying texts. By the way, I'm not here enough to feel the rhythm of your year and the pace of your year. I'm only here once a week, and I pop in and pop out. But I do feel that it's worthwhile. Every person here should be at some level. This is really the time to be conducting a midterm self-report card, looking at your year and give yourself scores. Because there is no report card, unlike high school where there are metrics. And the double challenge is that the success isn't really how well your mind's working, as it was in high school. High school, they superimpose those. How well can you read? How high do you score on the test? It doesn't really make a difference how well you read or understand. It's how much it's translating into whom you are. Is it affecting you as a person? Can you detect real change in parts of your personality? I don't know any of you well enough to try to tell you what areas to hunt down, but the classics are your tefillah, your midos, your behavior, your presence with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Do you feel that those things are advancing? If they're not, it's important to ask why they're not and try to find mechanisms to jumpstart that process, because you're in the wake of high school, and high school created a world in which you think that success is how your brain works. The truth is, it's not success in life, and it's really not success in religion. And when I look at the boys in yeshiva, I could care less how well they're doing in shiur. It doesn't impress me they can read a Tosfos well. They have more brain cells than I have, or than the boy next to them. What I'm looking for is, are you growing as a person? And that's a very, very different yardstick for each person, because you're very different people. So we can't issue report cards for growth. How are you growing? And we're not going to, because they're not infantilizing the experience. But you really have to hone in on that in a mature way, in an honest way, and say, who am I? And am I really maximizing the year from growth, from a growth perspective, not just from how well am I understanding Rav Meidan or how well am I understanding the Hebrew. Those are the gateways. Hopefully those experiences are, oh, now that I'm understanding Israel or my Israeli friends or Meidan or the Tanakh or the Gemara, the Da, whatever, all of a sudden I'm tapping into reservoirs of spirituality that I never knew existed. And now, again, don't confuse spirituality with emotionalism. Spirituality is for everyone. That means your spirit moves. For some people, that's emotional. For some people, it's cerebral. It doesn't. Sometimes people get a little uncomfortable. I'm not into that spiritual stuff. Into the, spirituality means your spirit moves. And it could be purely a product of intellectual activity. You read something important and you feel like HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered this word to you, and therefore your spirit is moved closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in very cogent and coherent terms. For some people, the triggers are emotional and the expressions are emotional. For other people, the triggers are intellectual, the expressions are. So triggers and expressions, but the move of your spirit is why you're here. You're not here to process information. You get that from books and computer or online. So this is what he's trying to encourage us. Look at yourself. Conduct a self-analysis. Conduct moral inventory, and that becomes the clarion call of the entire Musa movement. Another Gemara, which highlights how challenging it is to build Yerusha Mayim, it's not an automatic, it's not going to be implicit, is the Gemara in Brachos, a very beautiful Gemara in Brachos. Amr Chanina, Hakol Bidei Shemayim, Chutz Mi Yerusha Mayim. Famous line, who doesn't know that line? Shenemar, Ve'ata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elokech Hashem Me'imach, Moshe Rabbeinu says, come on guys, let me come clean with you. What does Hashem really, really want? Nothing. It's just it's so simple to be religious. What does Hashem want for you? Ki'im li'yiras Hashem elokecha. All Hashem wants is to fear Him. Everything else will stem from Yerusha Mayim. This is one of the five or six most important phrases and lines of Yerusha Mayim. Reishis chachma yiras Hashem, David HaMelech. Sof davar kol nishmas, tulikim yiras, v'sasef shmo kizek alad, v'enim koheles. V'ati so, ma Hashem elokecha, shomi, machkim yiras Hashem. Five or six lines in Chazal, psukim in Tanakh. And then the Gemara retorts and is shocked. Very famous line number three. Atu, Yira Shemayim, Milsos of Drasahi. Moshe Rabbeinu is trivialized. Like, it's so hard to be from. Like, Yira Shemayim, Milsos of Drasahi. I got to go a little bit off grid here just to show you that not everyone was born such as. So that didn't really happen. So I work during the show now. So, right. What is it called again? Plausible deniability. So it really didn't happen. But. So getting back to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's so easy, you're just trivializing, it's so easy to have Yerusha Mayim, Asa Yerusha Mayim, Milsa Zedrasi, it's very difficult, again reminding us that Yerusha Mayim has to be concocted and distilled, it's not something. And finally, the Pasuk in Eov, Vayomer Li Adam, more directly, Hein, Yiras Hashem, Hi Chachma, Visur Merabina. Yiras Hashem is a Chachma, it's not intuitive, it's not implicit, and of course Eov learns the hard way, because for him to arrive at Yerusha Mayim takes him 38 prakim and a lot of suffering, a lot of hardship, and a lot of confusion, and even borderline heresy. So it's obvious to us that we can't just assume, oh, we'll learn and perform mitzvos and be from and follow our masara, and then we'll all turn out Yerusha Mayim. What is it based on? How do you work at Yerusha Mayim? Of course, you always have to ask yourself, how do you define something? Then how do you work at it? Part of the brilliance of Maseilas Yesharim is he defines traits. What is the trait of Anava? What is the trait of Chasidus? What is the trait of Nikias? And then here are the Darche. These are the ways to acquire them, and these are the deterrents. So some people get stuck on the conceptual level trying to define a trait. Some people get the concepts right, but the execution, it's called the execution gap, where you know it's right, but the execution is hard. How do I arrive at those traits? That's not always so easy. But at least let's define today what Yerusha Mayim is meant to be. So classically, if you ask the average person Yerusha Mayim, and in fact the Baalei Musa really walked down this path, it's a basically fear, Yiras HaOnesh. There are consequences in life, there's punishment at a very visceral, physical level, and religion should be based in. And I more or less grew up in that environment, an environment of fear, an environment of consequence, an environment of, and don't get me wrong, we'll talk about why I don't think it should be the main pivot. I wonder if you have enough of that in your life. I wonder if in our liberal world, we have enough of that sense of accountability, responsibility, guilt. I was just talking to a boy in yeshiva, and he came over. We've had this long conversation, and we're supposed to have another conversation today. He said, Rabbi, I can't have a conversation. I just feel very guilty. I said, guilt is very good. Don't avoid guilt. Guilt is a very healthy part of the emotional religious landscape. Can't be overwhelmed by it. You can't be depressed by it. But living with guilt and processing guilt, it's just a healthy check on your conscience and a healthy check as to the disparity or the discrepancy between your goals and your expectations and your performance. And if you avoid guilt, you'll never be able to gauge that gap. So guilt is very, if there's one trait in the modern landscape, I'd like to reinstate its guilt. The ability to feel guilt in a healthy level, what did you say? What? Not Jewish guilt, not mother guilt, just healthy guilt, because you failed to live up to some of my deepest memories from when I was your age were the moments I felt guilty. I don't remember the moments I felt successful, because they just tended to disappear into the stream of my past. But the moments... at least I felt it was guilt, because I had expectations of myself and I didn't perform. Right, disappointment maybe takes the edge off a little bit, but a sense of accountability to self. This is what I expected of myself. I underperformed, and I'm sad. It depresses me. It makes me sad that I couldn't live up to my expectations. And I never let it thwart me or handicap me. I never let it freeze me into incapacity. But it was always an uneasy feeling. So a lot of people would say that's what Yirat Shamayim is. Interestingly enough, the Rambam doesn't really mention Onesh. The Rambam talks in more positive a sense about the beauty of Olam Haba and the tragedy if you don't merit Olam Haba. The lack of Olam Haba is the greatest onesh. What do we call that onesh? Kares. Kares is not suffering and hot tureens of water in which you're boiled or sulfur or ashes. A kares just means you don't fit in Olam Haba. And Olam Haba is the only reality after this world. So basically you end. I just to use this, some sort of metaphor, but I'm trying to take an American plug and putting it into an Israeli outlet. It's not a punishment to the plug, it just doesn't fit. You can't use it. So if you're not developed spiritually, you turn your back on this experience, you just have no compatibility with the next world. So you cease to exist. There's no you. And then you're just cut off. So the Rambam talks about Elu She'ein Lam Chelek V'Olam Haba. He doesn't talk about their suffering and their burning and the flames, and he just talks about Ein Lam Chelek V'Olam Haba, source number 6. People who are nechrasim v'ovdim, they're just cut off. Aminim, line number 3, apikursim, kofrim batara, kofrim b'tcheis ha'mesim, v'yes ha'gol. And when the Rambam describes Olam Haba in very positivist terms, 7, it's an important Rambam to read anyway, even independent of this year, just to remind yourself, you know, we're in this world, we embrace this world, we engage in this world, but there's something else waiting for us. Hatova hatzvuna letzadikim, the goal that we're all treading towards, chay Olam Haba. V'ha'chayim she'ein mavet imahem, endless life, immortality. V'ha'tova she'ein imara, unconditional benefit. Hushakasa batar laman yitav lecha ve'erachta yamim, harachas yamim. Anytime you have the word orech yamim, kihim chayenu v'orech yameinu, orech yamim means eternity. Yom shekulo arach. So, laman yaricho yamecha doesn't mean in this world, but you'll have end. Laman yaricho yamecha, arichos yamim means yom shekulo arach, not just you'll live to 90, 95. Arichos yamim, we use the word arichos yamim to mean older people, but it refers to Olam Haba. Okay, schar tzadikim, next, from my next page, sheyisku lenoam zeh, they'll merit this beauty, v'yubitova zu, upiron harishayim. Here is his description of the Piron HaRishayim. He doesn't talk about their suffering. Shelo yisku l'chayim elu. They won't merit this. Ela yichrusu v'yamusu. They'll just be cut off. They'll end. V'chol mi she'eno zocha l'chayim elu hu ames. She'eno chay li'olam ela nichras b'risho. Harsh words. V'avad ki beheba. He doesn't suffer. He's just a beheba. There's no soul. There's no soul to animals. Like when you have to be very, very careful today. Because, I mean, thank God we shouldn't be cruel to animals, and thank God certain people invest more of their emotional resources in animals. Some people feel that it provides an emotional comfort, more or less a decision you have to make, but animals are material. There's no soul to an animal. Human beings have souls. Animals are like leaves and water and the material, the carbon material. Of course, because they feel pain and because they respond in manners that at least suggest that they feel pain, it's hard to know. Modern psychologists, they don't, but whatever. So we have to be careful about Tzara Bala Chaim. We have to treat them with respect in ways we don't have to trees and there's animation. We have to treat that animation that has been delivered with respect and care. When an animal dies, it's the matter decomposes. There's no spirit to a dog or a spirit to a cat or a spirit to a frog. Or they don't possess spirit. So for the Rambam, that's a paradigm of a spiritless, non-futureless person. The Avad Kebehema. So it's really important. A couple of years ago, it was horrifying. I say this, no matter you do have a pet, you don't have a pet. You have to really mesle yourself in the right position. If you're on the right side of this conversation. Remember there was this animal, this... gorilla in Cincinnati who had to be shot because a child fell in Harambe or something. And the animal rights activists were horrified. And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. If any human life is endangered, you take the animal's life in a second. I jump in the cage and shoot the animal myself. Again, it was the parents' responsibility to make sure the child didn't enter that. We're certainly, as Jews, we protect Hashem's world, and certainly the animate parts of this world have to be protected with greater care. But don't fall into that space where you create equivalence between human beings and animals. And you create equivalence either in terms of rights of animals. Animals have no rights, period. There's no qualifier to that. Animals shouldn't be treated violently because that's not the way we behave. That's because of their rights. They could sue for their rights in a court of law. Animals shouldn't be treated violently because that's not how we're meant to. We're not meant to behave in brutal and cruel fashion. So the Rambam writes in source number 8, Hanakama she'ein nekama gedola mimenu. The greatest nekama, shetikaris, this is the continuation. This is halacha hey, paraches. Velo tiske li'osam chayin. That a person. So the Rambam talks about onesh, but it isn't in the gory fashion that we would think about onesh. It's just in the absence of inheriting this noam, inheriting this tov, inheriting this olam haba. Now he doesn't pivot Yerushalayim upon this, but he does describe it. Just give me a second just to complete the picture. The ones who most clearly pivoted Yerushalayim on this were the Musarniks. The early Musarniks, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and his Talmidim. Yisrael Salanter, early 18th century. He had three or four Talmidim that propagated the Musar movement. If you've been following the Musar movement, if you want to, of course, learn about them a little more, there is encyclopedic work by Dr. Katz. It's a 5-volume work on the Tenuat HaMusar. If anyone wants to look in it, he's got 50 pages on each personality, like the top 10, 12 personalities of the Musar movement. So we saw Salanter started this movement. It was a real movement. Namely, you're conscious that you're starting a movement. You're starting a new reaction. You're not just carrying on as normal. You write to people, let's make a change. That's what it means, a revolutionary movement. That you don't just, things evolve and evolve. The Hasidim were conscious of starting a new movement. The Musarniks were conscious. The former conservatives, Lahavdil, were conscious of starting a new movement. Zionists, let's start a new movement. So this movement is to try to focus attention and resources on moral improvement, religious growth as a person. And when they describe religion, it's very much described as pivoted on the fear of reprisal and the fear of consequence, but even in a more physical sense. So, for example, these two pieces that I photocopied for you that are not digitized, let's read the second one first, and then we'll go back and read the first one, because the second one, source number 11, is just a little bit clearer, and then we'll go back and read, I guess, let me just file source number 10. This is written in a sefer called Kochvei Or, Sharei Or, which is the sefer of one of his Talmidim, known as Reb Yitzchak Blazer. He had three Talmidim, Reb Yitzchak Blazer, Reb Naftali Amsterdam, and Reb Simcha Zisel Ziv. Yitzchak Blazer was a rabbi in St. Petersburg for many, many years. In fact, one of the ironies is that you had these two parallel movements that were trying to update Judaism, the Muslim movement and the Reform, ultimately conservative movement, and Naskilim / Reform conservative, not that they were all the same, but that whole attempt to try to modernize Judaism, and a lot of these Maskilim believed that the Musarnikim would be their allies. So they had raised expectations of these rabbis that they'll join forces with us. And when those rabbis denied it because they weren't looking to compromise on halacha, they weren't looking to empty traditionalism, they're just looking to add greater attention to Yerushalayim, so those dashed expectations created a lot of anger towards us. Nothing worse than a wife scorn or a person scorn. Those expectations are scorned. So there's a lot of infighting between the Maskilim and the Musarniks, even though they're both looking to update. And particularly acute with this, because St. Petersburg was the hotbed of Jewish cultural activity in the early 19th century. So Yitzchak Blazer was effectively run out of town by the Maskilim. So there's a lot of running rabbis out of towns, yes.
Was this before there were different forms of Musar movements? Because there's three different forms of...
Yeah, Nevardok, Slobodka, right? Yes, so way before. They only morph into separate streams, earliest, 1870, 1880. I mean, remember, Muslim movement is not something which is warmly embraced by the yeshiva world. Taking away time from Talmud Torah, taking away time from Tosfos, it's Bittul Torah, there are fistfights, actual fistfights in yeshivos in Europe as to whether you should or shouldn't learn Musar. So it's not taken lightly. So it takes a while for Musar to be established for then to be splintered into two or three different groups. Okay, so let's just read what his Talmud says. Yiras ha'onesh admor zechazad v'kadosh levrach. He's quoting his Rebbe Yisrael Salanter. This is part 11. Bidarche musarav, when he would deliver musar. Lo halach bigedolos v'niflos. He didn't speak about highfalutin ideas. V'lo nasam midabrosav al b'chinos ramos, about high issues to reach ramos. Shol darche yiras ha'ramos, about the awe of Hashem. Kiyim achaz tzadik darko derech hakodesh berove musarav rakmin yiras haonish kihi reishis das v'hatzad harishon l'avodasa yisbarach lios sar mera v'la'asos tov. And of course, he quotes the famous Gemara, line number 4 or 5 from the bottom. Histakel b'shlosh devarim, v'ena tabali de'avera, dami ayin basa, lana taholech, and anyone know when we recite this? You probably haven't been at one of these yet. Maybe you have. Recite this at a funeral. When we bury someone, we keep repeating this line until we bury. So there's nothing more reductive and nothing more foreboding or ominous than burying a person. We're not thinking about high-minded ideas about human potential and human. It's not slobodka mosa. This is to the bone, consequence, ayin basa, la'ana taholech. We just repeat this again and again as we put the body into the ground. And now I'm going to take you back to hear something again. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter didn't write a lot. He wrote letters to his Talmid and to his followers to like plan the revolution. No, not a militant revolution, to plan the transformation. So in one of these letters, Or Yisrael, source number 10, Yigeres Tes, Ata Mahi Hayira, Umakini Asa, how do you acquire Yira? Achasi. Harchavas Hadvarim Hanadayim Lakol. Yiras ha'onesh hanogea legevia v'nefesh. The suffering that the onesh will provide both for your body and for your nefesh. And the reason I wanted to read this with you second is because if you look at the end, here you hear the program of the Musar next. Because Musar established, recognized, that even though we know what's right or wrong cognitively, there's, as I said before, an execution gap. In the heat of the moment, we don't necessarily implement our ideals. So their challenge was how to enter the psyche of a person and establish those ideas at a subconscious level. Because there's something about our subconscious that's more powerful than our reason. Think about the last terrible sin you did, not just you made a bracha without kavanah, but a real sin. You committed a chait. I don't know what it was. You knew it was wrong, but there were forces larger than knowledge that were at work and that were preying on you with an E, and that were too powerful for you to oppose. So Musar understands, how do we get down to that sub-level? How do we descend into the human psyche? That's what makes them very pre-modern, because they're trying to deconstruct human consciousness and human psyche. So one of the ways that they wanted to get down to your sub-psyche is not just by studying ideas, but two ways, I would say. One is by screaming and shouting and repeating. So I can tell you an ideal, you'll know that it's right, but if I scream it, or you scream it 1,000 times, or you shout it at great volume, somehow that can infuse it into your subsystem. It creates a reality that's stronger than just knowledge. It's a subconscious assimilation. So in the Musar movement, there's a lot of screaming, and there's a lot of repetition. So for example, you want to be a good Musarnik, take a pasuk and chant it 5,000 times. Be like your teacher asking, I don't know if your teacher still does, to write on the board, I will perform my homework on time. I will perform my homework. I don't know if you guys got that. If I saw it in movies, right? I actually did that. I will perform my homework on time. I will perform my homework on time. So be like writing on the board 5,000 times or repeating, Shavisa Hashem L'negdi Samech, Shavisa Hashem L'negdi Samech. Boy, your education is very different than mine. You ever get soap? Who got soap? Anyone soap? No one got soap? You guys don't know what soap tastes like? Oh my goodness. Okay, rulers to the cheek. No one got rulers on the cheek? Slapped by rulers. Okay. Paddywhack. Anyone got paddywhack? Do you want to teach us a lap? Okay, so we got a... Yeah, right. Well, I got all of them. 1840s. Okay, so anyway, what are we talking about? So we're talking about chanting. The other part of the Muslim movement that was very popular was... Come on, let's get that yoga going. Body movements. Spilus. Get it in there. Don't just know what's right. Move. Action. Energy. Get. You walked into it. That's why they actually formed something called the Musar Klois. Because the Musarniks were just bothering the heck out of the people who just wanted to sit and learn. Can you imagine you're working on a Tosfos and you just want some peace and quiet? The guy next to you is flinging his arms, banging the desk, screaming, Shavisi Hashem L'negdi Samed! You say, shut up already. So they started to form an annex called a Musar Klois, a Klois in Yiddish. Klois. Klois in Yiddish means an annex. So every yeshiva that had a Musar element ultimately had a Musar Klois, to which the Musarniks were banished, essentially, because they were seen as lunatics initially. And they were put into the Musar Klois. My Zaidi was part of the Musarniks of Kelm. The one I'm named after, Moshe Yitzchak, well, I was one of the people in Kelm who was leading the Musar Reformation. So here you have this on display. Look at three lines at the bottom, part 10. Virak beharchava. Here's the phrase. Behispailus hanafshi tivaseid. Hispailus hanafshi. Nafshi means psychological. Your psychology has to be awakened. Hispailus hanafshi. It's a very important word in Muslim. What? Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Hispailus hanafshi. Laharchiv, here's another phrase. Laharchiv hariyon harayon, to expand the idea. Bitsirei chushi, with clear visual experiential chushi, chush, experiential description. Tsirei chushi doesn't have the words because psychology hasn't really happened yet, and he's writing in Hebrew. He's writing in rabbinic Hebrew, trying to capture modern psychological concepts, so the idea is going to be very vague, but that's what we know it to be. Experientialism, or physical experientialism. Okay, Le'orer HaNefesh, here's another great line. Le'orer HaNefesh Berikshah Seivarim. Le'orer HaNefesh, to awaken the soul, Berikshah Seivarim, with the excitement of the body limbs. Le'orer HaNefesh Berikshah Seivarim. Move the body, move the body limbs, that will awaken the inner spirit, awaken the inner soul. So I just wanted you to see that, having nothing to do with today's shir, because this is classic, classic Musar ideas about how to create Yerushalayim based on Yerushalayim. And then I'll tell you how Rav Amital felt, why this is no longer so relevant in our world. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting your name. I'm tired.
Leah.
Leah.
It was about before we were talking about Kari. Mm-hmm. Kari seems kind of like a final thing. Like when you get Kari, like you don't get Olam Haba anymore. Can you do tshuva for something that is like,
sure, the Rambam writes, the tshuva is just more protracted. It may include not just Yom Kippur and Chatayim, it may include Yisurim, but of course, yeah. Okay. Rav Amital felt that in the modern world, it would be difficult to base Yirat Shamayim on fear for two reasons. Primarily two reasons. Three reasons. First of all, because the fear of punishment suggests that we live in a world of cause and effect. And we know that for every action, there's an immediate reaction, and that creates a deterrent. So if I know that if I put my hand into a lion's mouth, he's going to bite my hand off, I'm terrified to put my hand into a shark's mouth. So there's fear of reprisal, because that really is cause and effect. But in the moral field, we don't live in a world of cause and effect. That's part of Hester Panim. One day we did, and one day we will. But we live in a world in which God's presence and the mechanics of providence are much more obtuse. So every person who sins has immediate punishment. Every person who commits a righteous deed gets rewarded. Not really. So because we live in this very abstract world without direct functioning cause and effect, it's harder to generate that fear. We can tell ourselves we do, but do you feel it? Because the consequences are so far off. Okay, we can read this Rambam, but we all know that this description of Olam Haba and the great concern about Karis will fade out of our consciousness once we leave this classroom and we get back into the world without cause and effect. And to remind us that we don't live in the world of cause and effect, Rav Amital, first of all, highlighted people who did live in that world, the Tanaim lived in that world. So, for example, source number 12, there are two Tanaim who were imprisoned by the Romans. One was the famous Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, who was burnt with the Sefer Torah. The other was Rabbi Elazar ben Parto, who was less well known. And there's a jailhouse conversation between Rabbi Hananya and Rabbi Eliezer. And Amalei Rabbi Eliezer, source number 12, ben Parto, line number 2, le Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, Ashrecha, shenitpasta al davar echad. You're so fortunate that the Romans apprehended you because you taught Torah. And you know exactly why you were apprehended, and you know exactly why they're punishing you, and Hashem will protect you or compensate you in Olam Haba. But he says, I, oily, shenitpasti al-chamisha dvarim. He evidently was a ganav, and he also taught Torah, and he also, I forget all the five averos that he was indicted for, but it was a medley of teaching Torah and commitment for Avodas Hashem, and also some regular crimes. Whatever their conversation is, it's clear that they're able to attribute direct cause and effect. You were thrown in prison because you taught Torah, and therefore it will be a human punishment rather than a divine punishment. I was thrown in prison because I was a thief, and also taught Torah, and essentially I'm going to be punished in a more concerning fashion. I don't know. I don't remember what his theft was. Was it real? Was it not real? I don't know if he was an actual thief. But that's not important right now. What is important is that they're looking at a world in which there's cause and effect. We don't live in that world. And in fact, Chazal recognized that at a certain point we're no longer going to live in that world. In the next Gemara, the Gemara says, the name of Yochanan. Yochanan is much later Amora. So now we're 200 years later, after Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, more or less the year 200, 300. Yochanan says, Kol hamarech b'tfilasel. If you daven too long, uma'ayin ba. We don't know what the word ma'ayin ba means yet, but you're ma'ayin and you're davening. Sof bali de ke'ev lev. You'll have pained heart. You'll have pained emotions. Why is someone who davens too long, why does he experience ka'ev lev? I don't know. It's a very oblique Gemara. We turn the page and look in Rashi, source 14. Uma'ayin ba mitzapa she'te'aseh b'kashaso a'idei rachaso. You expect there to be an immediate response to your tefillah. If I'm davening with more kavana, and I'm davening with greater energy, then maybe Hashem should really answer me. But that's not the world we live in. And you have expectations that won't be met. And again, those dashed expectations will cause a lot of anguish and a lot of sadness. So if you daven a long Shemon Esrei, there's nothing wrong. Maybe it's not fair to other people. But if you assume that your tefillahs will always be answered, you're setting yourself up for heartache. I remember two times. I remember when Nachshon Waxman in the early 90s was kidnapped by Arabs, and we daven and we daven and we daven. I was just so certain that Hashem would answer our tefillos. And Hashem answered our tefillos, just sometimes we don't know how he answers. Sometimes the answer is no. And certainly a couple of years ago, you're probably old enough to remember when the three boys were kidnapped and how hard we daven. I remember standing at the Kotel crying like a baby, but I was with 50,000 other people crying. Well, I was not the only one. It was just so raw and so obvious that this was... Can't get any more obvious. Right in the middle of Kever Rachel and Maris Machpel, right in Gresh Etzion, three boards. Like, what more do you need? This is an obvious chance for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rescue us. There's nothing complex about this. And Hashem gave us an answer. We don't always know how to decode. And I remember Rachele Frankel. I always tell this when I see her. So I think she carried the day. First of all, I think she carried the day, by the way, and I told her this also at the Shiva. I said that, I don't know if you were following. You may have been a little bit too young to follow. But she's a well-known speaker. Obviously, she's become more well-known afterwards, but she was a pretty well-known educator. But I think she and the others, they just shone the shine during those 3 weeks just because they were such great mothers. And the love for their children and that lioness sense that I'll protect my child at all costs and I'll travel to the UN and I will... And for some reason, the mothers came to the forefront during that process, the three mothers, and she was one of the leading ones. I just told her, you taught, in my opinion, us... that just being a great mother, and of course, some people want more and deserve more, and some people not, but there's so much avodas Hashem and so much beauty in just being a great mother. And to me, that's not really being a female. I can't comment on this personally. To me, that's the challenge that you girls are going to face. There's so much more that is expected of you, and it's also offered to you, and those are two different things. But don't invest in those at the cost of the traditional roles that have been so important that you should continue to play. And I don't know what the answer to that is because I've never been in your predicament, but I know that it'll be a big travesty if we just supplant motherhood with professional advancement or motherhood with being great scholars or motherhood. I know that you'll suffer as people because I think it's hardwired to whom you are. And it's the beauty of being a woman, and I see it in my wife, and I see it in other people. I've seen it in other things. And it's, of course, at a societal level, it's so important. I know there are things I can't provide as a father. Right? Just make sure that one doesn't come at the cost of the other. But anyway, Rachele Frankel was at the Kotel with a whole bunch of high school kids who were davening and davening and davening. She turned to him and said, Hashem is not our employee. He doesn't have to answer to us. We can daven to him, and he can also choose not to answer us or to say no or to say yes in ways that we don't understand fully, or yes or no's. So you have to be careful about creating a world in which you expect your tefillahs to be accepted or you expect your actions to have a reaction. That is the world we come from. That is the world we'll one day recreate, but that's not our world. And in that world, it's harder to feel fear of reprisal and fear of punishment because there isn't directness.
Just going back,
sure.
The Gemara about them being in prison. So there's a Gemara in Brachot, right? It's like the beginning, the first paragraph talks about like there's like a whole very confusing thing about like Tov Tzadik and Ra'ah Tzadik. So it seems like the Tanan had some understanding of this. So couldn't you just understand this, that like Kal Vachomer, that it was a person who was not like obviously the greatest if he was also imprisoned for other things, that he was had a simplistic understanding of it, and that it wasn't, that there was not such like a clear cut. Because there was, I'm saying there is like, there's a bright already, like there is that seemed to exist, that it wasn't so clear cut for
but
them.
But again, that's not what I've been charged as answer, so evidently it's not just this speckled Tana, but it's also Chanan ben Trajan who allows that assumption to remain and just responds one note, so he doesn't question the note.
It's like a super confusing thing that doesn't really make any sense. beginning of Brachot. Like there's a brisa about that.
Right. I'm assuming that Tanaim weren't monolithic, and some Tanaim viewed their world in ways that are more reflective of our world, Zadav Ralo, Rosh Hashanah. And others felt they had the right to process their realities. The question of how you process it, the world is the world, but subjectivism means how do you process your reality? They process their reality, and they sense more cause and effect, and they live that way. And certainly during the Roman times, there was a lot of persecution. I think they were able to create that. Oh, we're suffering. Move in Yehuda, or the brothers were able to say, Abel Hashem v'Menachnu Ola Hatzara. So we don't have that today. It's very hard to say, I'm suffering because, or I'm losing my finances because. The reasons and the triggers and the input is very, very vague. What does Hashem want from me? Why is this happening to me? How can I change? It takes a lot of generalization.
I'm not saying that we have that, but I'm just asking like if they really
have. Right, I understand, bro. I understand. The tie. Ty, do you have a question?
Oh, Leah.
I'm sorry.
Mine is a similar question. Are we saying that they, like what you were saying, that they experienced their reality in that way? That the world actually was more like that?
It definitely was closer to that because it was closer to the prophetic era and certainly in the days of the Beis HaMikdash. And then it's a question, again, I think this is a seam line between understanding Gemara well, but also scholarship and reading about how they behaved outside of their statements and where they live. That's certainly not my field, but you have to know a little bit about their history and how they interacted, and you have to see scholarship. But I think that there was enough of an in-between, of a median experience, that some people took it one way, some people took it another way. Don't assume that Chazal speak is one course. You're talking about 500 years of the greatest collection of minds, with the greatest commitment to Talmud Torah that ever lived. And there's such a sweep and a diversity of people and opinion. The greatest mistakes that people make, I found, is when they assume Chazal spoke in monotonic fashion. And not only that, but they were skilled enough in the way they spoke that even one statement can incorporate multiple levels of meaning. Same way a Kadosh Baruch Hu statement can incorporate 70 levels of meaning. Shakespeare, Lahavdil, can write a line that means two things, double entendre. So Chazal can certainly write a line that means two, three, four, five ideas all at once. So it's very hard. Oh, what about this Gemara? Okay, we have that Gemara. What about this Gemara? What about this Brisa? When did he say this? But he also said this, or someone else said this. So it's really hard to, if this is what Chazal meant. It's more of a osmosis. We read the body of Chazal and you get a sense of how they viewed the world, how they saw their world, and how they built the world for us. The second, yes?
Sorry,
were you? No, that's fine. Okay, so you obviously realize it's not a question to ask it.
Yeah.
For no, not that it's a bad question, but it's a really, maybe I'll give a shiur on tefillah. Maybe not for Amital. But one thing I can say just to set the platform. Don't let anyone tell you that. The tefillah is only for yourself. Hashem created a world in which you can change as well. As puzzling as that sounds, you can change as well. Tomorrow's reality is a product of your tefillah tonight. And maybe not only your tefillah, maybe other people's tefillah, Kodesh Baruch Hu's decision, but your tefillah counts. And no tefillahs go unanswered. And how it will count, and how it will ricochet in Shemayim, and what small, trifling effect it will or won't have, no one knows. But tefillahs matter, and Kodesh Baruch Hu created that ability, Vayifka b'makom, Yaakov is a pogan, Kodesh Baruch Hu, he makes a change, and that's why it's called tefillah, milashon plilim, because you're going to court with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and you're trying to create change and prosecution. It's also self-introspective and contemplative and reflexive, for sure, but be very, very careful about entering that world where tefillah is solely yoga meditation. It is not. It is following the path of our avos, reciting their tefillahs, and expecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu to intervene for us as he did for them. Now, we're in a very compromised state right now. Remember, we're in a reduced state of national identity. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash, we don't have Nevi'im, we don't have... So how Hashem answers and where he'll answer, we're trying to reverse many, many, many years of frustration. So it takes a while for the relationship to heal. The relationship is healed a lot because we have our land back and we have Hashem obviously protecting us, but we still have a ways to go. But be very, very careful. That is that I wouldn't say is heresy in the sense of denying resurrection or denying... You could emphasize that more. You could say certain times in the world, certain davenings are more prone to introspection, but to create a world of davening, which is totally, totally self-introspective is completely, completely false. Completely false. Okay.
I mean, I'm fed to go to Zion.
Okay, he speaks that way, you know. And the truth is, it's not Avodah Zarah, because that was furthest from Avodah Zarah. The pagans actually thought they could manipulate their gods in ways that were very artificial. Let's just sacrifice some virgins, let's pay homage, let's praise them. So if anything, it's a complete break with the ancient world of paganism. But he just uses, you know, he says things for effect. He's my neighbor. I hear him at night practicing. You know. Quiet already. Go to the muscle collection. Anyway, I'm trying to focus on mitosis here. Anyway, sorry. I used to have a donkey in the backyard, so anything less than the braying donkey is already pretty tranquil for me. You know, yeah. I don't know why, but he had the donkey. Okay. So I didn't bother asking him. The second issue that Rav Amital took, and this is really classic Rav Amital and classic Rav Kook, and really listen carefully, girls. This is important to be honest and authentic. Is that we've, in the post-World War II era, after we defeated Nazism and after we fought those two horrifying wars, people emerged with a very dominant character trait that they either possessed or that they aspired to possess. And you see it in all the movies. And it's called courage and fortitude and bravery and all of our stars in the right. And look at movies before Hollywood, you'll see that there's before the wars, there's less of that. We fashion ourselves as brave people. We try to be, and there's nothing wrong with that, because I think that's the spirit, that's the geist in 2020. If you ask me, one of the non-classic traits that I try to emulate in Rav Amital, not the classics, piety, dominance, I think he was a very courageous person. And that courage expresses itself in many different ways. And when I feel frightened, not by backyard brawls, but I feel frightened by issues in life, I try to summon the courage that I saw in Rav Amital, try to be a courageous person. I think, so all of a sudden, the human spirit is veering towards a world that emulates courage and defiance and strong will. And then you're going to try to build religion on fear? It doesn't connect. You see my hand? It just doesn't. It misses. And that's the tragedy. When religion misses, it becomes very formulaic. You just go through the motions. You say things. You repeat slogans. And it's not real. It's not authentic. Like, talked about four different forms of Musa. I think a lot of people today, in my opinion, unwisely, are reading the old-style Musa. The world is dark and full of demons and goblins and meaninglessness, and it's a maze, and you don't know the way, and it's empty, and it's... Okay, we're finished Musa. Let's get into our SUVs with our Apple iPhones, climb on the jet, and go on vacation to Bermuda. When did that happen? It's like there are 2 years? It's religious schizophrenia. In the base Medrash, I'll make believe the world is dark and terrible. And let's go to the Mets game, Yankee game. Oh, Mets are terrible. We'll go to the game, and we'll go to the kosher restaurant. We'll get on the cruise, and we'll go to our vacation. It's just, there's no continuity. It's all just role-playing. So all of a sudden, we're going to be strong and defiant and brave and courageous, and then all of a sudden, we want to be firm, let's be afraid. This one made Ramita so brilliant and true, because he was willing to dig deep into human identity and say, we have to form a Yerushalayim that makes sense in the post-World War II era. We can't just copy and paste from 1920, from 1880, because those realities are gone. And the third issue, which Rav Kook talks about, we'll read both of those, I think we'll stop here and I'll just continue next week. The third issue is that fear is a contracting agent. It stifles potential. When you're afraid, you shrink into yourself. You're very cautious. It suffocates. And again, we see ourselves as amplifiers and as augmenters. So too much fear is going to crimp accomplishment. And even if it doesn't, then again, I'll just be disconnected, right? You don't put on a Siyum HaShas for 90,000 people without a sense of pride and belief in yourself and creativity. And then, so again, you could make believe you're afraid, but you're not. That fear is not the dominant element, because it's creativity and self-expression. It's really our world. Let's read some of this in Rav Kook. And this is why Rav Amital felt that we could no longer, in 1975, let's say, we can no longer pivot Yirat Shamayim on fear of onesh, fear of reprisals. Not just because we don't live in that world, but because it's not consistent with the spirit of our age. And the spirit of our age has to find a Yirat Shamayim. Again, many people would disagree with this. In all fairness, if I invited, let's say, I'm just imagining a Haredi person, he may come in and he would say, no, that's not right. those ideals of Yirat Shamayim are eternal, and you have to superimpose them on your current reality. And even if it's not authentic, it's just the way you create an alternate reality, you step into that reality, and even if it's not continuous. I'm just giving you my opinion on how I view religion, how I view Avodas Hashem. It's not the only one. Don't deride others or don't disparage. It's what I feel lends the greatest depth and truth to how I try to be an Oved Hashem, and consistency. I can be an Oved Hashem every minute of my life because it's the same frequency that I'm operating under. Let's read two aspects of Rav Kook. One is in Mamar Hador. Im eino matil alav, source 15. Shum eimo bepachat. Shekvar his'ale betchunas al mlios mamit ofi l'chayav. Man has already transcended his Allah from building his life, line number two, mipnei pricha mipachad, running away from fear, bein muchashi, whether it's physical and visceral fear, bein siuri, whether it's psychological, bein chomri, physical, bein muchani, here it is, hatzaros v'hatlos, hanaros, all these terrible sufferings and these nightmares, these holocausts, these wars of the 20th century, asu, line three, Lenoksha vi'az. Man is now strong and stiff and resilient. Ad shekol balahotu pachadim. All the fears, lo yizazu, are not going to shake him. Or shouldn't shake us. Hu mukshar rak lehisromin. He just wants to take off. He just wants to transcend. He just wants to raise his spirit. Lelechas bi'arachayim. To follow a path of life. Haolechas lemaila lemaskil. A higher level. Even if you want to be, you can't be kafuf, bent over, shachuach, persecuted, no say all, burdened. You're not going to find the light of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this spirit. So Rav Amital was very influenced by Rav Kook. We already started to envision this change in the human spirit, even ironically before World War II. It's even pre-Holocaust. Can you imagine what Rav Kook would say post-Holocaust? Which is always, that, I mean, that's what makes any claim. What would the great Rabbanim say about the state of Israel? Well, the Holocaust and the current state of Israel were two facets that were completely unimaginable to anyone in 1925. So to go back to 19, what would they say about? It's like asking me what I'd say about, I don't know, brick number 3256 in the Great Wall of China. I've never seen the Great Wall of China. I've never seen brick number 3256. So. And it's the Great Wall of China. It's not my backyard wall. It's thousands of kilometers long. So sometimes you say, oh, boy, in 2025 at the Aguda conference, he said, or I won't say she said, there's no she's, but at the Aguda conference, this rabbi said, what planet are you living on? 1945 and 1948 are not just years in the last century. They are major, major seismic shifts. 6 million Jews, the destruction of an entire world. You can't compute that. The state of Israel, how many people in the state of Israel in its formation? 600,000. How many boys got deferments from armies? 300 or whatever. 30, who knows. Now there are 10 million people living in the state of Israel. Baruch Hashem. More Jews than anywhere else on this planet. So it's a different world. And we do our best to try to find answers to our world. But don't follow the 1925 import from 1925. It's folly. And Rav Kook is getting it. Rav Kook is sensing that the world is changing. It's always fascinating to read people who are sensing the world is changing before everyone else. And Rav Amital really had that. That's really a great way. Rav Amital saw trends 10 years before they happened. Always got this sense, oh, it's going to happen in 10 years. And it really happened. If you want to read an author like that, Kafka really got it also. You read some of Kafka's works and you read it well, especially more of his frontal works. He in the 20s and 30s understood that the world was in contractions, was wildly oscillating, there were a lot of changes in his writings. You get, oh, in 1970 or 2000, it's clear that's what happened, but he's writing in 20s and 30s. The second issue that Rav Kook speaks about, and this is, of course, in Source 16, HaMusag Shel Yiras Hashem is meant to be Mosif Oz, V'Gevura B'Nefesh Adam, should create more strength and resiliency. Listen to Rav Kook. It's really powerful words. It's supposed to make life. Yiras Hashem should make life. Content and dreams and ambition. Should fill you with ruchanius niskava, transcendent spirituality. It should purify your talents. Be'or esh kodesh, in the radiance of Hashem. Amnam, however, if it's the wrong Yerushalayim, and this is the counter, liftaim, for silly people, himit yatsevet, Yerushalayim appears kisemel shel behala, panic. Hagorem is rifyon, weakness. Yeush, despair. Chasron onim, a feeling of inadequacy. Zos hashpa, he ra'a miyod. It's terrible. Uruch l'sheish tispashet. And when it happens to, permeate, higoremis iskomumus, then it, here's the danger. It causes a reaction. What's the reaction? You don't like feeling contracted. You don't like feeling your talents depressed. You don't like feeling suffocated. And then you rebound and you rebel against religion. It causes a reaction. That's why some people, when people see religion as that way, they run from it. Rather than saying religion is amplifying and augmenting. And that's basically the question of religious maturity in a nutshell. How do you view religion? Is suffocation and no's and deprivation and you can't? Or basically this is the best way to lead your life and you would choose it, quite frankly, even if Hashem didn't legislate it. Let me put it to you differently, okay? You dream. You go to sleep tonight. You're all really tired. I'm tired. You go to sleep tonight. Hashem comes to you in a dream and says, you have 24 hours off. 24 hours, you can eat whatever you'd like, drink whatever you'd like, touch whatever you'd like, behave. 24 hours furlough, no consequence, no cause and effect, no you're selfish. I would imagine that most of you, probably all of you, I think, are at the stage where you would tell Hashem, no deal. I'm not in this because I feel stifled and I'm waiting for an out. I'm just dying. I know that every mitzvah you gave me, some I understand, some I don't, is beneficial. And quite frankly, I choose this life even if you wouldn't command it. If there were, so there's no mention of Alma Ba in the Torah because the Torah doesn't want to sell religion as a collapse of this world, just a punch your ticket to the next world. This is the best way to lead your life in this world. Even if there wouldn't be an Alma Ba. So the Torah doesn't mention Alma Ba explicitly. There are references to it. So that in a nutshell, so Yiras HaOnesh as the pivot of that is essentially, I feel like thunderbolts and lightning and Hashem is always looking at me to punish me and just, it doesn't make sense in the modern spirit. It doesn't adhere to a world in which cause and effect has become more shadowy. And ultimately, it doesn't amplify human spirit. It just depresses it and suffocates it. And therefore, Amital felt that in 1975, speaking of random year, we have to find some new formula for Yerushalayim. Next week, we'll see what other formula he rejected, why he rejected it, and what formula he proposed. Okay, I don't want to take this lightly. I think building Yerushalayim is important. I think you should balk in the face of trying to be explicit about religious strength and religious growth. And part of being an Oved Hashem is learning to talk in terminology of Avodas Hashem. I think, how much in high school did you talk about Hashem? And even the times you did, and this is just a pet peeve of mine, but even the times you did, he wasn't in the room. Who was in the room? God was in the room. Again, there's nothing objectively different between Hashem and God, but in our parlance, God is philosophical. We share God with the world. We share this concept. This Hashem is ours. Ribbono Shel'olam is ours. Again, this is just words. You can flip the words. But our reality, when you talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribbono Shel'olam, Hashem, you know who we're talking about. Okay, Avram, okay, Yitzchak, okay, Yaakov. Hashem who gave us mitzvahs. Hashem who's answering our tefillos. Talking about God, we're thinking about a New York Times article. It's no one's fault, but that's how we lock into it. Just say the right language. I don't want to be religious. I want to be from. I don't want to be morally kind. I want to be Yirei Shamayim. I also want to be a Baal Chasadim, and I also want to be morally kind. But try to, if sometimes you'd be surprised how changing the language can change the effect. Because language really clothes our ideas, and it shapes the way we think about ideas. But speaking about Yirei Shamayim is important. And don't be afraid to talk about, are you a Yirei Shamayim, and how could you improve that? And talk to your friend, and you know let's take our Yirei Shamayim temperature. Like, how are we doing? And what is Yirei Shamayim? Well, don't do it till next week, because next I'll tell you how to take that. I'll give you the thermometer. Get ready to start this week, okay? Okay, I'm going to crawl my way home in traffic.